Hi, welcome to the Behind the Balance Sheet podcast, where we meet leading investors and commentators and educate ourselves about the world of investing and the world. Our mission is to remove some of the mystique around investing and improve our understanding of what makes a successful investment, or indeed an unsuccessful one. Our goal is to inform, educate, and entertain. We hope you enjoy this and every episode.
Behind the Balance Sheet and affiliates and podcast guests may own shares or have an economic interest in securities discussed in this podcast, which is aired for your education and entertainment only. Nothing in this podcast should be construed as investment advice or relied upon for investment decisions. Always do your own research.
In this episode, climate finance expert Hugh Van Steenis and I talk to Barry Norris, founder and CIO of Argonaut Capital. Barry is a climate skeptic and has made good money out of shorting Ørsted, the Danish offshore wind company, which has fallen 60% from its peak. Barry explains why he thinks there may be more to go, because he considers the economics of offshore wind are fundamentally unsound. He likens wind and solar to unreliable workers and thinks nuclear and fossil fuel generation are the reliable workers. And he says you cannot have a factory staffed only by unreliable workers. We think you'll find some of his arguments really interesting, and I encourage you to learn more, to read the show notes, and also get the newsletter accompanying the podcast. You can get that at beyondthebalancesheet.substack.com. Please enjoy our discussion with Barry Norris. Barry Norris, I'm really excited to talk to you. I'm really looking forward to our conversation because I know you've got some very controversial views. And listen, you started Argonaut in 2005, so almost 20 years ago, crikey. And you had, I don't know, was it about 7 years of investing experience before that? Is that right?
Yes, that's about right.
Did you always want to be an investor? And what gave you the courage to launch your own firm at what would it be, age 30? I mean, that's quite brave.
Foolhardy, some might say. You know, I got into investing, I wouldn't say by accident, because it was certainly a conscious choice, but without really having thought much about my post-university career until about 5 to midnight when I was about to leave university. So my first degree was at university, was in history, and then I did a postgraduate in international relations. But I wanted to do something where I could think about the world. And one of the things that is obviously great about being a fund manager generalist is that pretty much everything that goes on in the world, certainly in economic terms, is interesting. And you have a massive choice to discover and invest in many different industries. So there's a massive sense of freedom doing that. But it's also, I think, an industry for the intellectually curious. And you kind of never run out of things to be curious about. The great Charlie Munger always used to say that, you know, an investment career is an accumulation of wisdom, which I think that's right. And the fact that he was still investing in his 90s, obviously the logical consequences of that is you start off in investing with maybe some instincts and some intelligence, but that's a different thing than investment wisdom. I've always thought that if you think about the career of fund management, there's a lot of, well, I wouldn't say there's a lot of, but it's easier to have a few good years in a row than it is to still be investing when you're 90. Staying in the game means that your good years aren't just because you took a lot of risk. You know, inevitably, if you drive the car in fifth gear all the time, you're going to crash at some point. And, you know, I think the really good investors know when to accelerate and know when to decelerate and have some idea of investment cycles. And I think one thing also that I think I've learned is that, you know, people always expect you to, when you start your fund, you know, what's your process? How do you do it? And frankly, what you might have started with shouldn't be the same 10 or 20 years later, because you should have learned something. You should have accumulated some wisdom and worked out how to do it better. you know, that's what I love about fund management. And also, of course, you know, the two most important things in most people's lives are their family and their assets. And for someone to trust you with their money to manage is an incredibly, something that one has to take one's fiduciary duty incredibly seriously. And that's not lost on me either. And certainly, you know, as opposed to perhaps many people in the industry today that have to find an additional moral purpose for ESG in investment, I'm very happy to say that making a return on people's savings and allocating capital more efficiently than government would ever do is enough moral purpose for me.
Totally. Well, so Barry, I mean, there's lots we could pick into, but maybe we should start that you argued recently that sort of the energy transition has been a monumental misallocation of capital. And so, you know, Steve and I were just keen to dig in, you know, why do you think it's been such a policy folly and where are they getting the economics wrong?
So I think to answer that, we have to look back at the history of energy transitions. And I'm, you know, I'm a keen economic historian. So looking back at history, well, you know, if you think about from Roman age to the Industrial Revolution, GDP per capita really didn't change much in 2,000 years. And then we had the Industrial Revolution, which started in Britain, which basically involved the replacing of a wood-driven energy economy with coal. And coal was amazing because it had so much more compact chemical energy, which could be converted through steam into mechanical energy. And that saw, if you look at GDP per capita over the last 2,000 years, it's like Michael Mann's climate change hockey stick, except the data isn't manipulated. So it actually is really flat for 2,000 years, and then it goes up exponentially because we discover energy. They don't seem to teach that in schools. And I think most of modern society isn't aware that you cannot have a flourishing high GDP economy, per capita economy, if you don't have cheap energy. And if you think what happened at the end of the 19th century, oil and gas started to replace coal. Coal usage keeps growing, but grows more slowly, but you just get oil and gas being the dominant energy. And of course, that led to a revolution, particularly in transportation. And if you think about, you know, the history of the 20th century, you know, perhaps one of the reasons why the Allies won World War II is that America at the time produced 80% of the world's oil and gas, and the Germans were reliant on extracting synthetic fuel from coal. With each of these energy revolutions, you basically get an inferior product replaced by a superior product, which is cheaper and more bang for buck in terms of its power. Now, nuclear could eventually replace oil and gas as a dominant fuel because it's even more bang for buck. But the problem with nuclear is that we haven't yet worked out a way to do it efficiently. And there's, you know, it's pretty difficult to store and move that nuclear. It's not particularly agile, not as agile as oil and gas. And therefore, we haven't really worked out how to do it yet. While this energy transition is different, is we're kind of going back to inferior forms of energy that our predecessors gave up on, you know, not being particularly efficient, not giving enough bang for buck. And in terms of energy return on energy investment, there's really hardly any surplus. And if you think about the costs of building a nuclear plant, which are very high, the cost of plutonium that goes into this massive energy generated, you get a massive surplus. But if you think about the costs of manufacturing a wind turbine or solar cells, then actually you're already starting with a big sunk energy cost. So you can't generate the surplus from the generation that society needs to sustain itself and sustain GDP per capita. And I think before you get into any debate about CO2 and man-made CO2 and whether it ends up with an existential crisis, you've got this basic point that actually wind and solar can't do anything other than lead to lower GDP per capita and lower standard of living.
And then you've got the problem as well that Windows solar being intermittent doesn't really solve the problem of how you power energy grids, because, you know, the very nature of electricity, the beauty of electricity is we can just flick a switch and we can use the electricity. If we're in a, you know, we've moved to a net zero, supposedly, economy, and we are reliant more on electricity. And remember, electricity is only 20% of all our power generation in the UK at the moment. Then there is always going to be the problem of, are we going to move to some kind of Mad Max dystopian economy where we only go to work when the wind blows or the sun shines, because that's when we've got electricity? I think the net zero zealots still haven't figured out is that intermittent power is not really very helpful for energy grids. And in fact, when the market share of intermittent power goes above 10%, below which it's not really, you know, that relevant, it leads to, it's exponentially useless, because you just can't store it, you can't consume it, and you could export it, but then you're exporting to countries where the wind's also blowing at the same time, so the power price is really low. So if you think about Boris Johnson's plan for Britain to become the Saudi Arabia of wind, I would argue that that is seriously flawed, in that what he was trying to say is that the Saudi Arabia produce oil at $10 and sell it at $90 and they make a massive gross margin on it. The problem is in the UK is that when the wind blows, we already have low power prices. And we already have enough installed capacity to use for wind to generate all of our needs, but only when the wind blows. So the problem when the wind blows in the UK is we can't just switch industry on when the wind blows, and therefore we can't consume it. We can't store it because of the costs of storage, which we can go on with. And we can't, if we wanted to export it, we've basically got to pay people to take it, because all over Europe, the wind is all blowing at the same time.
But hang on, because you're making a number of points there, and I just want to unpack, as our American friends would say, unpack some of those. So obviously, wind and solar are intermittent producers. You said that when the wind is blowing here, we can't export it because the wind is blowing elsewhere. Now, I just want to understand. I mean, I've got no knowledge of where the wind blows, in spite of the fact that I'm Scottish and the wind seems to always blow in Scotland. But if we have more offshore wind in the North Sea, will it not blow at times when the wind isn't blowing from the existing turbines? I mean, the wind can't blow everywhere all at once, can it? Or is that a false premise? Yeah.
When it's windy in the North Sea, it's windy in the Irish Sea. And I think the problem is as well, there is if you look at Denmark, where wind is just over 40% of their power generation, that is kind of the model we're trying to get to. But Denmark is a small economy, and it's in the Nordic power market. And when the wind is blowing, Denmark could export, often not very profitably, to Norway, which prime generation is hydro, or to Sweden when prime generation is nuclear, and vice versa. But if you look at the prices that Denmark exports wind at, it's a lot lower than the prices that Norway sells them hydro and Sweden sells them nuclear, reflecting the fact that there's a premium on energy on demand and there's a massive discount on intermittent energy.
That's quite clear. So let's just explore this for a minute, because this value of the energy is critical to the whole equation, isn't it? And the problem that you have, if you're selling gas, the value of a therm of gas might be 50 pence on average in the year. But on a cold winter's day, it might be £1.50. And at 7:30 in the morning on a cold winter's day, it might be £2.50. The problem here is that not only do you have the fluctuations in demand, but you have the problem with supply. So it's a compounded problem. Is that right?
I mean, if I've understood your question correctly, just like in any commodity, the spot price will reflect the cost of incremental supply to meet demand. Yeah. And energy is a spot market because power prices will fluctuate throughout the day because obviously there's less power used at night and there's more during the day. There's more power used in the winter than the summer. And also the cost, just the cost of storage is incredibly high. So if you think that there's a battery that is being built in Trafford, Manchester, costing £750 million, and it's going to be able to store 2 gigawatt hours. And that's the equivalent to about 3 minutes and 20 seconds of our average use. So if you think that we're 100% reliant on wind and solar, you would have to build thousands of these batteries to back up the storage. So I think this is something that, you know, unfortunately, the logical critical thinking about power grids and energy has just been left behind in the kind of political and quasi-religious debate that we have on.
But well, the point I was just trying to make was that we've always had to have the ability to service those extra spikes. So I was thinking about the gas industry. It's always had to have that incremental marginal demand. And electricity and the wind and solar is kind of like the converse of that, isn't it? Because you can't have just wind and solar. You need to have a backup supply of capacity. I mean, that just means that that they're more expensive sources of supply. But that's not necessarily a bad thing if we're prepared to pay the price in order to reduce the emissions.
I would look at it the other way. I would look at it and say there are very few applications for where power, when it wants to turn up, relative to power when you need it.
Oh, sure.
So the analogy that I've used is basically a grid needs reliable workers. And unreliable workers are pretty much no use at all. And the only reason you've been able to get away with unreliable workers is if they're a very small market share, but they're still useless, right? And so the problem is you're basically, you think of the UK grid as the factory.
Yeah.
And we're basically saying we're going to tax reliable workers, which are the gas-powered power stations, and we're going to subsidize the unreliable workers, and we're going to give the unreliable workers 15-year contracts, and we're going to make the reliable workers kind of whatever we want. We're not going to even give them a contract. They're just going to have to turn up when the unreliable workers don't turn up. Now, what would be the consequence of that on the factory's productivity? You could basically hire as many unreliable workers as possible, and it still wouldn't solve the problem because they might all still not turn up one day, and you'd have to go back to the reliable workers. So actually, the unreliable workers have no value at all relative to the reliable workers.
What you're saying is they've got no economic value, but they may have a value if we put the right price on carbon, the right price being enough of a price to justify.
Because that doesn't affect when they turn up.
No.
That just says that the tax rate on the reliable workers doesn't alter the economic behaviour of the unreliable worker.
So Barry, look, I take your point, and also we need to distinguish here between also the investment opportunity and then the fundamentals, because obviously if the government's choosing to subsidise, you might still want to take advantage of that. But anyway, if you do a trade-off between energy security, the affordability, and then the environment, your hard thesis is to have zero renewables. You could say there's a case where if you're constrained of how much gas you can buy, let's say Germany was, having a proportion of your energy mix coming from renewables, which is obviously then much better on the environment, you know, there's a percentage where it might actually be helpful. So I don't know. I'm not sure I'm getting why zero is the right number.
Right. Even if you believe that climate change, man-made CO2 emissions are going to cause existential crisis for society, which frankly I don't. If you've got an economically useless product, which wind and solar is, what's the question to which that's the answer? Because I get the fact that if you actually believe in the existential crisis, environmental crisis, And probably, given that this is an investment podcast, we shouldn't go into that. Wind and solar doesn't solve that if it's economically useless. You can only solve that. You can only solve that problem if you've got a product which can replace oil and gas, and then you work out, well, what's the additional cost of replacing oil and gas? What's the premium I'm willing to pay to replace oil, to replace fossil fuels? Is that premium something that we can afford to pay as an economy without ruining the economy? But if what we're saying is we know wind and solar is the unreliable worker, which is never going to power the grid because we're still going to need the reliable workers, however much you pay for it, it's still, and however much generation capacity you've got, it still doesn't solve the problem because it doesn't economically replace the reliable worker. So therefore, if you really want to have a net zero generation, the only way to go down it is nuclear and hydro. And because hydro isn't scalable, you have to build nuclear. But, you know, in reality, that just gives you a nuclear-powered grid. And electricity is just 20% of all of our energy use. And energy consumption is different from energy production as well. And the other thing that we've been doing, obviously, in the UK is kind of off-balance sheet CO2, moving the manufacture of the electric car to China, and the carbon footprint of making the battery in the first place. And then when it gets into the UK, on the assumption that electricity can be produced on a carbon-free basis, we bring our footprint down, but really you're just robbing Peter to pay Paul because the electric car has still got that footprint from day one that was made in China.
We'll get to electric cars in a minute because I want to just finish off on the wind, because I don't think your argument is well understood in a wider sense. Now I want to just make sure that we cover it, because what you're saying is the government wants to have 45 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2030, and you think that's daft because the amount of wind we've got today is enough when it's windy. Is that right? Is that the same essence?
Yes. So the constraining factor here isn't the amount of generation capacity we've got in the UK. It's the weather. And since the days of King Canute, you know, we can't control the weather. Or maybe we can. Maybe that's what climate change tells us. We can if it's man-made CO2. But I don't believe we can control. We can't make the UK, we can't make the wind blow in the UK more consistently. That is the problem.
So if when it's windy, we've got enough wind power to power most of the country.
Correct. So I don't know why I was the first person to do this analysis, because it seemed to be pretty obvious. But you can break down power generation in the UK into half an hour discrete periods. And it's important to do that because basically the closest the spot you get, the more accurate your data is, because everything gets lost in an average over a day or over a month or whatever. So you break it down and you could say, what I did in my research, which is on our website, is say in those discrete half an hour periods, what was the wind market share and what was the spot power price? And basically what it tells you, I mean, there are lots of other things that impact the power price as well as whether it's windy or not. You know, the price of gas, whether it's summer or winter, whether it's kind of half time in the football match, whatever. So you've got all this noise in the data as well you've got to try and filter out. We basically demonstrated that over, you know, the last three calendar years, whenever the wind market share has been very high, i.e. the wind has been blowing, then the power price is very low. And whenever the wind market share is low, the power price is very high. And conversely, whenever the power price is very high, the wind market share is also very low. And whenever the price is low, the wind market share is also very, so all those four kind of variables of it. Now that tells you that we already have enough generation capacity in the UK to take advantage of the wind when the wind blows. So the question I have is, given that we can't make the wind blow more consistently or blow more, what is the purpose of building more? And you kind of get two answers, right? One is, well, we could store the surplus in an effective and cost-effective way, which, given the costs of batteries, you can't. And I think the net zero Zlots have lost that argument, and they've now moved on to hydrogen as a way of storing it as well, which, you know, we could go into it, but that's also just an economic cul-de-sac. So this, if you can't store it, well, we can export it. Again, show me a day when, you know, our weather is coming from Scandinavia and Germany in general. So generally, when the wind blows in the UK, the correlation to the wind blowing in the rest of Europe, the export markets, is also high. Therefore, the export opportunities only come when the power price is low. So then the question is, okay, Barry, we get that. So why are all these wind companies prepared to build their wind projects if they could only make a loss when they're exporting it? And the answer to that is, it's not their loss, because that's why they build these projects with a guaranteed price. And that's why they refuse to build them unless the government guarantees the price. So let's look at our scenario where, you know, the latest guaranteed price in the auction this year is going to be £75 per megawatt hour. Now, it's important to think that that's in 2012 prices. So I don't know why they try and make it this complicated. So you've got to get an inflation adjustment to that, which means that today is about £100 per megawatt hour based on the inflation we've had since 2012. And over the 15-year length of the contract, the price goes up by inflation every year. It may be 100 today, it may be 150 on average over the length of the contract. The reason why that price needs to be guaranteed is because the wind operators are able to insulate their own business from the costs of intermittency, and those costs of intermittency are passed on to the UK electricity consumer in the form of higher energy prices. So your average, you know, Danish wind farm that is building most of these wind projects, they don't care about intermittency because they've passed that economic risk onto the UK electricity consumer. And so even though their business adds no economic value, it's a massive con whereby they are pretending it does, but they're passing on the cost of that to the UK consumer.
If you enjoy this podcast, you're bound to enjoy our free newsletter on Substack. It's a weekly email on interesting investing topics. Visit behindthebalancesheet.com and hit the sign up button. While you're there, you might want to check out our brilliant online investor training school. Hundreds of students have taken our flagship Analyst Academy course, which teaches you everything you need to become a serious equity investor. And if you're a professional investor, we run a forensic accounting course for institutional clients, and soon a cohort-based course for serious amateurs. Email us at info@behindthebalancesheet.com.
So Hugh, why is the government set this goal to have all these wind projects in the North Sea? What's the political imperative?
It is partly, as Barry said, is because they're trying to copy the sort of Danish type model of getting a higher percentage of wind. And, you know, look, to be fair, there is a trade-off of energy security, the price and the environment. We can disagree what's the right way to do it. And I'm with Barry. I would definitely go more nuclear. But nuclear, to be fair, doesn't swing. It's a very level load. And so, you know, even the French originally were going to try and have 80, 90% of their energy from nuclear, and they had to cap it because they couldn't swing for the, you know, the winter and so forth. But you're right. I would have a much sweeter mix of nuclear, but it's to try and, you know, go more like, you know, as I say, go more like the Nordics. Sorry, Barry.
Steve, if I was to say, why do they do it? Because they don't understand how energy, particularly electricity markets, work. And they think that net zero is politically popular, and there is a groupthink in the way that they've all believe that this is the way forward without questioning it. And that's the basic problem. But I think, as Hugh rightly points out, ironically, nuclear doesn't blend well with wind and solar, because you can't. The problem with nuclear's got the opposite problem to wind and solar, and it's on all the time. Yeah. So you can't switch nuclear off. So the way that you have to actually do it is gas is superb at balancing. This is the value of gas. And actually, we already halved our CO2 emissions in the UK. Part of that is we got China to manufacture a lot of things that were dirty. But it was mainly because we switched from coal to gas. And gas has got about a quarter of the CO2 emissions to coal. So, you know, I think the problem is that once you say you want to go to zero carbon emissions, you never actually realize how we halve the CO2 emissions. So we switch coal to gas without actually switching to an economically inferior product. In fact, it was economically superior because the cost of extraction were much lower. And that's why halving CO2 emissions was actually economically beneficial, because of the way we did it. We switched to a cheaper source without impacting the quality of the power generation. Now, one of the problems, but by saying we want to get to 100% net zero, rather than we just stop at 50% because we've done our bit, or we do 80% as we were going to do up until a few years ago, is that you actually remove the fossil fuel, which is the best for power generation, which Britain's got a lot of, which could be extracted cheaply. But because it's got some CO2, you say, oh, we don't want any of it. And that's the problem. We need to recognize the value of gas. And I was just looking before we started this podcast. The gas price per megawatt hour before carbon tax at the moment is £20 per megawatt hour. So it's a fifth of the cost that we're paying in the next wind auction for wind generation, and it turns up when we want it to turn up, right? And we could easily get, if we have an electricity network which is predominantly powered by gas with some nuclear, we could cut our CO2 emissions by 80%, certainly in terms of electricity generation. I'm not quite sure about transportation, but that is the relatively painless economic way to do it. And of course, there is lots of gas, indigenous gas in the North Sea. There is lots of gas that we could frack in the UK, and we could actually export energy to the rest of the world. The pound would be strong again, as it was in the 1980s. The best economy, apart from Norway, in the entirety of Europe.
Yeah,
I mean, that's why this political thing to get to net zero is so economically devastating, because we give up gas, which is so incredibly valuable.
The thing I don't understand is why there hasn't been a lot more research done on carbon capture and storage. And there was quite a lot of initiatives, I mean, quite some time ago, before, you know, in the 2000s. And then the government kind of sort of ran out of steam. It seems bizarre to me, but the problem
I think, to be honest, Steve, carbon capture is, you know, I'm not going to criticize the motives of people involved in carbon capture, but you're basically addressing the wrong question. This, you know, carbon capture is something that if you give any company enough subsidies, it will tell you that it can do something economically useful. I think just carbon capture is going the wrong way about it. Think about it this way. Carbon capture is a way to keep using fossil fuels, but to reduce CO2. What we've done by not realizing the value of gas in the whole of Europe is that we end up burning wood, which is the one fossil fuel which has got more CO2 emissions than coal. Yeah. And we call it sustainable because you can grow another tree. Well, if you wait long enough, you could wait for more fossil fuel to grow under the sea.
So just one thing on nuclear, because the issue with nuclear is it's quite expensive. You've got the risk of the capital cost in the construction, and you've also got the risk in the decommissioning, the cost of the decommissioning. I mean, do you have a view on what it costs?
I'm invested in Cameco, and I've had some investments in nuclear on the basis that at some point, governments will have to realize that intermittent forms of power generation are economically ruinous. And then the next place they look will be nuclear. Because they can't get out of this religious net zero thing, so they'll go to the next best thing, even though it's more expensive. But if it was down to me, I still think nuclear involves a hell of a lot of sunk capex. We haven't worked out how to do it cheaply. And frankly, it's less economically ruinous than wind and solar because it's economically useful, the product it produces, but it still is a very heavy price to get to net zero. And my point is, we've halved our CO2 emissions just by switching from coal to gas. If you get rid of the net zero CO2 and just say, we'll have some, we'll aim to halve again from here, you could have an economy that is powered by gas, and that would be very cheap. And I mean, if you think about gas today, £20 per megawatt hour for gas, if we actually started drilling for it and frack it for it, we could export it again.
Don't use that word fracking. I don't want people demonstrating outside my office. That's
but it's totally illogical, this aversion we have to fracking. Let's leave
these politically contentious things, because we want to talk about investing. And if you're right, and if people start to believe you, and we stop spending as much on wind and solar, one of the consequences of wind and solar is that you have to change the grid. That's true in the UK. It's true in the United States, because where you get the sun and where you get the wind isn't where you get the people, where the people consume the power. So there's been quite a lot of investment going into companies that can service that. So thinking about the stocks, those stocks that are benefiting from the reinforcement of the grid, is that dangerous, do you think?
Yes, because talk about if you're in a hole and you keep digging. It's just like you've got something which is economically useless, which eventually, the irony, Steve, is there's a whole industry of sustainable investing which is totally unsustainable because it doesn't produce anything of any economic worth. It's totally reliant on government subsidies, and it only works when interest rates are zero. So, if wind and solar are unsustainable in that way, and at some point when the economy hasn't grown for 20 years, governments realize that one of the reasons why it hasn't grown is we went down this wrong-headed net zero path, then all the other investment, you don't need that either. So I just wouldn't be in these kinds of investment.
Okay. No, that's fine.
But somebody said to me 10 years ago, what is sustainable investment? I'd have thought something is still around in 10 years' time because it made enough profit to still be around. But there seems to be a new definition of sustainable investment.
But Barry, to be, the shift in interest rates has moved the world a little bit more in your direction. Because what? The biggest interest rate shock in 45 years, has hit the renewable stocks incredibly hard. I'm sure you've probably shorted some of them. You had some very big moves. And, a lot of the private equity guys are investing in LNG and actually across Europe. And even with the green taxonomy, gas got jammed in as well at the last minute. So I think, beneath the big rhetoric, the facts on the ground are shifting. So, but I don't know if that's... may not be as fast as you want.
Yeah, I mean, I think, the bulls on alternative energy will explain everything that's happened in the last 2 years solely as a function of interest rates. I don't think that's true. I think it's a function of the fact that the product that these companies produce is economically worthless. And the fact that interest rates are not zero anymore means that they have to demonstrate that it is worthless and it can make a profit outside of being subsidized. You know, my point would be that this whole form of investing has run out of political capital because governments have reached a limit of how much it can sustainably subsidize these industries when government debt is already very high. It's run out of investor capital because they've all lost so much money and it doesn't work. They can't lever up. You know, the reason why zero interest rates worked is that you only got a return as an equity investor if you could stuff the project with kind of 95% debt, and therefore you could lever that 5% equity. When interest rates go up, you can't do that anymore. You have to have much more equity, and that's what makes it a marginal economic product, just completely useless when interest rates are higher. And then thirdly, I would say that, you know, the consumer, and you can see this all over the energy transition, doesn't want to buy the energy transition products anymore. So it's run out of, you know, and they're fed up with more useful products being banned. So the whole thing has been reliant on government coercion as well. So if you think about, I don't know, you know, just talk about the electric car. Now, I argued 18 months ago that, you know, we were at a peak electric car 18 months ago because those people that could afford to buy an electric car and wanted to do so as a kind of penitence for their sins, which is the way I look at a lot of this spending, had already done so. And everybody else, people that couldn't afford it, just said, well, you know, if I'm not prepared to buy an electric car because they're more expensive, I've got to charge it overnight and electricity prices are high. If ever I want to do a journey more than 10 miles, I worry about running out of electricity. And yet 18 months ago, analysts covering the car industry had us going to 100% EVs in the Western world in between about 5 to 10 years. And I said at the time, this is just groupthink. This is never going to happen. And therefore, I would say the problem with this whole energy transition is, irrespective of the debate whether we need to cut man-made carbon emissions because of the theory that these are causing rises in global temperatures and that we can't mitigate those, or that they don't have other things that will rebalance them, like, you know, more green plants doing photosynthesis or more water vapor as cloud also being something that will stop the earth heating up. Irrespective of all of that debate, we've reached the end of this. We can't do it in the economically additive way that we were promised. So we were promised that the energy transition was going to be pain-free economically. And I think people have realized that, irrespective of the climate change debate, that was never true. And when you get into that economic debate, you then say, well, what am I prepared to pay for net zero? I think what frustrates me is that this is the biggest economic question of our day. And actually, I think we've been allowed to debate how much it's going to cost, which is why I focus on that. Once you debate how much it's going to cost, we can leave it to others to actually have a debate about man-made CO2 emissions and their effect on climate change. And certainly, in a properly functioning democracy, you don't have a parliament that decides to go to net zero after a two-minute debate and no vote, which is what we had in the UK.
I mean, the whole reason that we're doing the podcast, Barry, is to better understand the economics. I mean, that's why we're...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
that's why we're doing this. And, I mean, the logical impact of all this is that it's inherently highly inflationary, isn't it? Because you're investing in unproductive capacity.
It's economically destructive. You obviously have then a political choice as to whether it's inflationary or deflationary. It's deflationary if you do nothing about it. So all of this will lead to a massive misallocation of capital, It could only be sustained by more government borrowing to fund subsidies and government coercion to ban more useful things. Therefore, you get lower GDP per capita. And then the government has a choice, because that's obviously politically unpopular. So you have a choice at that stage. You either drop it and backtrack and say, well, maybe actually Britain might be a better place with it's 2 degrees warmer. And have a different narrative and say, you know, all these scientists that were wrong all along, they misled us. Or you say, we're going to print money. And that's where you're right, it's inflationary. Because you have to have a gap in society. You know, if you're not growing productively, if real GDP isn't growing, well, not nominal GDP growing is the next best thing for politicians.
So is your portfolio positioned that way?
From the outside world, it might seem that this is the only thing I ever do any research on or articulate in my portfolios. But actually, I have a, you know, my day job is managing a long short fund, and I have a lot of different things going on. The important thing when you're managing a fund, and particularly a fund which, you know, is my duty, as it were, is to generate double-digit uncorrelated returns in a sustainable way, i.e. a consistent way, I can't allow my views on any one subject to dominate my portfolio. So I'm solely here to maximize profit.
Sure.
You know, we've done well shorting some of these ESG stocks over the last couple of years, but they've not been the only thing we've been shorting. One of the things that I think I look for in things to short in the market is where you think there's an area of the market where there's just a lot of groupthink and people have just bought into a narrative and have actually, the economic behavior and the investing behavior has just become dominated by a narrative without any kind of discussion of numbers or how sustainable the profit generation.
AI, that sounds like AI.
Well, yeah, it could well be AI, but, you know, thankfully we've not had any shorts in AI yet. But you say, you know, you started your business when you were 30. I mean, I think that's just also a function of the fact that there are certain people that work well in bigger organizations and certain people that work well in smaller organizations. And kind of, you know, being able to step back and think about things in a really critical way, I found I'm more able to do that as kind of like a lone ranger rather than being part of a big battalion. Because I think as soon as you're part of a big organization, your thinking becomes dominated by, well, you know, what do I need to think to advance in this organization, rather than I've done some value-added research and I think I've got a view which is differentiated. You know, I'm not doing down a skill set that could do well in big companies or people that are consensus builders or stuff like that, but I would say that's not a good trait to have in investing.
Interesting.
I was just going to say, so look, given, in terms of your thesis then, given we're now to the third year of the renewable stocks underperforming and actually by big numbers, do you think the best of the short is behind you? Or do you think there's a lot more to
do? I think that you can all... No, because all of these companies will eventually go to zero without government subsidies.
The government subsidies are quite long dated, so they could drift along for quite some time.
Yeah, potentially. If you look at... So you look at, let's say, Ørsted, where we've had a short for the last 2 years. Now, what really attracted us to Ørsted was obviously the thesis on offshore wind, and that was the best way to play it. But also that, you know, this is a company that just reports group accounts. You never get any insight into the individual projects unless you're prepared to look at the local accounts filed in Companies House of the wind projects. And so you never get a good insight into the actual levels of leverage in the business, because often they'll proportionally consolidate the special purpose vehicle, and you know there's loads of off balance sheet debt, blah blah blah. Now, I think part of the thesis in Austin played out last year in that they basically, they couldn't produce wind power for below a subsidized price of £100 per megawatt hour. And they therefore they had to write down a lot of projects and not do their projects in the US. And, you know, that it stopped by being a growth stock to people actually thinking, well, actually, maybe those bullish assumptions I made just aren't true anymore, and I'm worried about the balance sheet and how it funds it. But the company managed to kind of explain it away by saying, well, we need to raise prices because of temporary supply chain issues. So my point is, well, why do you need to raise prices given that your contract you're being awarded is over 15 years and not 2 years, and you're already got these upwards only inflation adjustments, so you're already compensated by inflation in the contract. So, and most people bizarrely have bought into this, and they also think that, okay, if you look at the offshore wind CFDs in the UK, basically they were all above £100 per megawatt hour up until 2017, when they dropped to 50, and then they kind of went down to, I think, about 38 at the low. And bear in mind, we're talking about, it's not the proper number because it's 2012 prices, but most of their assets in the UK have been built on those £50 headline CFDs. So how profitable are those going to be? So I would say, you know, all of those assets, they haven't been written down. None of the analysts are saying, so all of these assets that you've built in the UK for £50 CFDs, how profitable are they? They're not profitable. And then you think, right, if you think the average subsidy still in the UK for wind generation is probably nearer £150 per megawatt hour, simply because the subsidy regime is even more generous before 2015, where you had, you know, £150 CFDs or ROC certificates and all of this. So there's also the question of, what's the life of the wind turbine? Because they tell you it's 15 years, and they can point to the wind farms that are still very profitable that have been going for 15 years. But they're only very profitable because 15 years ago, the subsidy was £200 per megawatt hour. Try upgrading the turbines when you're only getting paid £50 per megawatt hour, and you're in deeper and deeper water because all of the best sites have already been taken. And then you think about where the Labour government wants our capital to be allocated. They want to do even more of this, not less. It's going to be a massive scandal.
Well, listen, Barry, that seems like a good point to end this wonderful conversation. It's been fascinating talking to you. We are doing this to get both sides of the story because we want to get at the truth. So, Hugh, Barry, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Oh, before we go, I should just ask you, Barry, where can people find you? I always forget to ask that.
Yeah, so a good starting point is our website, argonautcapital.co.uk, and the main fund I run is the Argonaut Absolute Return Fund, which is a long-short equity fund.
Cool. Well, we'll put that in the show notes. Thank you. So, Hugh, that was really fascinating talking to Barry Norris. Well, I mean, what did you take away from that?
Oh, look, I think it was a great conversation. Look, I was really struck by how deep he had gone on the economics of renewables, and that without major continued government subsidy, and also, quite frankly, free money, the economics just didn't stack up for him. And I think, you know, if you think about why the stocks have underperformed, a lot of it has been this huge shift in interest rates. But if the particularly European governments are on the back foot from the fiscal point of view, it's going to be very tough for them to continue to subsidize. So I think that the economics and the pressure point I thought was really interesting. What about you?
I think he's a really, really good communicator, isn't he? Because this idea of looking at it like a factory with reliable workers, the gas-fired and nuclear workers, and the unreliable workers, the solar and the wind, and it doesn't matter how many unreliable workers you've got, because if they're unreliable, and particularly these aren't unreliable because randomly, they're unreliable in a controlled, systematic way. And I thought it was quite interesting him saying that when the wind blows in the North Sea, it also blows in the Irish Sea. That I mean, I'm taking his word for it, but that was something that was new to me. But you have spoken to people in the past about this idea that we've got enough wind already, haven't you?
Well, look, you know, look, everything in life is a balance, isn't it? But certainly, even 3 years ago, you had days where you're getting over 90% of energy, let's take the UK, produced by renewables. Now, that's more in the summer when it's windy. But and that's obviously continued. I think you've also had 100% day in the last 12 months as well. So I think that there is support for that. I think the challenge, and this is something we're going to investigate with other people, with guests we speak to, is what's the right balance between energy security, energy affordability, and the environment? And the challenge is that with the different now, with the tragic war in Ukraine and the energy shock and the interest rate shock, actually there's a very different trade-offs being made by policymakers around the world. And that's why, this is why it's so complex to invest around.
And the whole thing is really fascinating. And there's a political dimension to this as well. And I wonder, you know, if we knew what it costs, if we knew what net zero was going to cost, would we want to invest in it? I mean, I guess the answer must be we've got to, but maybe this isn't the most efficient way. But I thought that was really interesting. I think it's a good idea to get somebody that's skeptical and understand the other side of the argument, because we don't want to just speak to people that are, I've got ESG funds.
Exactly. No, absolutely. Well, look, but you know, look, I think what we're going to continue to explore is just the economics of transition, because let's be honest, it's the transition that's where the money's going to be made.
Absolutely. Well, listen, thank you, and I'll see you next time.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Steve.
Well, Hugh and I were agreed that Barry made some convincing arguments against wind power, his unreliable workers. But is that the whole story? We'll hear another perspective later in this series. We hope you're enjoying these shows, and feel free to give us your feedback by emailing info@behindthebalancesheet.com. And don't forget to sign up for the newsletter at beyondthebalancesheet.substack.com. See you next time.